Wiggle Waggle Village was sort of depopulated with no greenies to play the fairy tale parts, but Fred and Lane had reactivated all the mechanicals. The magic beanstalk that shot out of the ground in a burst of steam, the witch cackling in front of the candy house, the Mad Hatter's tea party, the nightcap-wearing wolf who lurked beneath one of the underpasses and sprang at the train as it passed. As we rounded the final turn, we passed three houses all kids know well. One of straw, one of sticks, and one of bricks. "Watch out for pigs!" Lane cried, and just then they came waddling onto the tracks, uttering amplified oinks. Mike shrieked with laughter and yanked the whistle. As always, the pigs escaped. Barely. When we pulled back into the station, Annie let go of my hand and hurried up to the engine. "Are you okay, hon? Want your inhaler?" "No, I'm fine." Mike turned to Lane. "Thanks, Mr. Engineer." "My pleasure, Mike." He held out a hand, palm up. "Slap me 5 if you're still alive." Mike did, and with gusto. I doubt if he'd ever felt more alive. "Now I've got to move on," Lane said. "Today I'm a man of many hats." He dropped me a wink. Annie vetoed the Whirly Cups, but allowed Mike, not without apprehension, to ride the Cheroplanes. She gripped my arm even harder than she had my hand when the chair rose 30 feet above the ground and began to tilt, then loosened up again when she heard him laughing. "God," she said. "Look at his hair, how it flies out behind him." She was smiling. She was also crying, but didn't seem aware of it, nor of my arm, which had found its way around her waist. Fred was running the controls and knew enough to keep the ride at half speed, rather than bringing it all the way up to full, which would have had Mike parallel to the ground, held in only by centrifugal force. When he finally came back to Earth, the kid was too dizzy to walk. Annie and I each took an arm and guided him to the wheelchair. Fred toted Mike's crutches. "Oh, man." It seemed to be all he could say. "Oh, man. Oh, man." The Dizzy Speedboats, a land ride in spite of its name, was next. Mike rode over the painted water and one with Milo, both of them clearly loving it. Annie and I took another one. Although I had been working at Joyland for over 4 months by then, I'd never been on this ride, and I yelled the first time I saw us rushing prow first at Mike and Milo's boat, only to sheer off at the last second. "Wimp," Annie shouted in my ear. When we got off, Mike was breathing hard but still not coughing. We rolled him up Hound Dog Way and grabbed sodas. The Gazuni refused to take the 5 spot Annie held out. "Everything's on the house today, ma'am." "Can I have a pup, Mom, and some cotton candy?" She frowned, then sighed and shrugged. "Okay, just as long as you understand that stuff is still off limits, Buster. Today's an exception and no more fast rides." He wheeled ahead to the Pupalicious Shy, his own pup trotting beside him. She turned to me. "It's not about nutrition, if that's what you're thinking. If he gets sick to his stomach, he might vomit, and vomiting is dangerous for kids in Mike's condition. They..." I kissed her, just a gentle brush of my lips across hers. It was like swallowing a tiny drop of something incredibly sweet. "Hush," I said. "Does he look sick?" Her eyes got very large. For a moment, I felt positive that she was going to slap me and walk away. The day would be ruined, and it would be my own stupid goddamn fault. Then she smiled, looking at me in a speculative way, and then made my stomach feel light. "I bet you could do better than that if you had half a chance." Before I could think of a reply, she was hurrying after her son. It really would have made no difference if she had hung around, because I was totally flummoxed. Annie, Mike, and Milo crowded into one car of the gondola glide, which crossed above the whole park on a diagonal. Fred Dean and I rode beneath them in one of the electric carts, with Mike's wheelchair tucked in back. "Seems like a terrific kid," Fred commented. "He is, but I never expected you to go all out like this." "That's for you as much as for him. You've done the park more good than you seem to know, Dev. When I told Mr. Easterbrook I wanted to go big, he gave me the green light."
"You called him?"
"I did indeed."
"That thing with the roses. How'd you pull it off?"
Fred shot his cuffs and looked modest. "A magician never tells his secrets. Don't you know that?"
Did you have a card and bunny gig when you were with the Blitz Brothers?
No, sir, I did not. All I did with the Blitzies was ride jock and drag the midway. And although I did not have a valid driver's license, I also drove a truck on a few occasions when we had to DS from some rube branch or another in the dead of night.
So where did you learn the magic?
Fred reached behind my ear, pulled out a silver dollar, dropped it into my lap. Here and there, all around the square. Better goose it a little, Jonesy, they're getting ahead of us.
From Skytop Station, where the gondola ride ended, we went to the merry-go-round. Lane Hardy was waiting. He had lost the engineer's cap and was once more sporting his derby. The park's loudspeakers were still pumping out rock and roll, but under the wide, flaring canopy of what's known in the talk as the Spinning Jenny, the rock was drowned out by the calliope playing A Bicycle Built for Two. It was recorded, but still sweet and old-fashioned. Before Mike could mount the dish, Fred dropped to one knee and regarded him gravely.
"You can't ride the Jenny without a Joyland hat," he said. "We call them dog taps. You got one?"
"No," Mike said. He still wasn't coughing, but dark patches had begun to creep out beneath his eyes. Where his cheeks weren't flushed with excitement, he looked pale. "I didn't know I was supposed to..." Fred took off his own hat, peered inside, showed it to us. It was empty, as all magicians' top hats must be when they are displayed to the audience. He looked into it again and brightened.
"Ah."
He brought out a brand new Joyland dog top and put it on Mike's head.
"Perfect. Now which beast do you want to ride? A horse? The unicorn? Marva the mermaid? Leo the lion?"
"Yes, the lion, please," Mike cried. "Mom, you ride the tiger right next to me."
"You bet," she said. "I've always wanted to ride a tiger."
"Hey, champ," Lane said. "Let me help you up the ramp."
While he did that, Annie lowered her voice and spoke to Fred. "Not a lot more, okay? It's all great, a day he'll never forget, but..."
"He's fading," Fred said. "I understand."
Annie mounted the snarling, green-eyed tiger next to Mike's lion. Milo sat between them, grinning a doggy grin. As the merry-go-round started to move, A Bicycle Built for Two gave way to 12th Street Rag. Fred put his hand on my shoulder.
"You'll want to meet us at the spin. We'll make that his last ride, but you need to visit the costume shop first. And put some hustle into it."
I started to ask why, then realized I didn't need to. I headed for the back lot, and yes, I put some hustle into it. That Tuesday morning, in October of 1973, was the last time I wore the fur. I put it on in the costume shop and used Joyland Under to get back to the middle of the park, pushing one of the electric carts as fast as it would go, my Howie head bouncing up and down on one shoulder. I surfaced behind Madame Fortuna's shy just in time. Lane, Annie, and Mike were coming up the midway. Lane was pushing Mike's chair. None of them saw me peering around the corner of the shy. They were looking at the Carolina spin, their necks craned. Fred saw me, though. I raised a paw. He nodded, then turned and raised his own paw to whoever was currently watching from the little sound booth above customer services. Seconds later, Howie music rolled from all the speakers. First up was Elvis, singing Hound Dog. I leaped from cover, going into my Howie dance, which was kind of a fucked up soft shoe. Mike gaped. Annie clapped her hands to her temples as if she'd suddenly been afflicted with a monster headache, then started laughing. I believe what followed was one of my better performances. I hopped and skipped around Mike's chair, hardly aware that Milo was doing the same thing, only in the other direction. Hound Dog gave way to the Rolling Stones' version of Walking the Dog. That's a pretty short song, which was good. I hadn't realized how out of shape I was. I finished by throwing my arms wide and yelling, "Mike! Mike! Mike!" That was the only time Howie ever talked, and all I can say in my defense is that it really sounded more like a bark. Mike rose from his chair, opened his arms, and fell forward. He knew I'd catch him, and I did. Kids half his age had given me the Howie hug all summer long, but no hug had ever felt so good. I only wished I could turn him around and squeeze him the way I had Haley Stansfield, expelling what was wrong with him like an aspirated chunk of hot dog. Face buried in the fur, he said, "You make a really good Howie, Dev." I rubbed his head with one paw, knocking off his dog top.
I couldn't reply as Howie. Barking his name was as close as I could come to that. But I was thinking, a good kid deserves a good dog. Just ask Milo. Mike looked up into Howie's blue mesh eyes. Will you come on the hoister with us? I gave him an exaggerated nod and patted his head again. Lane picked up Mike's new dog top and stuck it back on his head. Annie approached. Her hands were clasped demurely at her waist, but her eyes were full of merriment. Can I unzip you, Mr. Howie? I wouldn't have minded, but of course I couldn't let her. Every show has its rules, and one of Joyland's hard and fast was that Howie the Happy Hound was always Howie the Happy Hound. You never took off the fur where the conies could see. I ducked back into Joyland Under, left the fur in the cart, and rejoined Annie and Mike at the ramp leading up to the Carolina Spin. Annie looked up nervously and said, Are you sure you want to do this, Mike? Yes, it's the one I want to do most. All right, then, I guess. To me, she added, I'm not terrified of heights, but they don't exactly thrill me. Lane was holding a car door open. Climb aboard, folks. I'm going to send you up where the air is rare. He bent down and scruffed Milo's ears. You're sitting this one out, fella. I sat on the inside nearest the wheel. Annie sat in the middle and Mike on the outside where the view was best. Lane dropped the safety bar, went back to the controls, and reset his derby on a fresh slant. Amazement awaits, he called, and up we went, rising with the stately calm of a coronation procession. Slowly, the world opened itself beneath us, first the park, then the bright cobalt of the ocean on our right and all of the North Carolina lowlands on our left. When the spin reached the top of its great circle, Mike let go of the safety bar, raised his hands over his head, and shouted, We're flying! A hand on my leg, Annie's. I looked at her and she mouthed two words, Thank you. I don't know how many times Lane sent us around. More spins than the usual ride, I think, but I'm not sure. What I remember best was Mike's face, pale and full of wonder, and Annie's hand on my thigh where it seemed to burn. She didn't take it away until we slowed to a stop. Mike turned to me. Now I know what my kite feels like, he said. So did I. When Annie told Mike he had had enough, the kid didn't object. He was exhausted. As Lane helped him into his wheelchair, Mike held out a hand, palm up. Slap me five if you're still alive. Grinning, Lane slapped him five. Come back anytime, Mike. Thanks. It was so great. Lane and I pushed him up the midway. The booths on both sides were shut up again, but one of the shies was open, Annie Oakley's shooting gallery. Standing at the chump board where Pop Allen had stood all summer long was Fred Dean in his three-piece suit. Behind him, chain-driven rabbits and ducks traveled in opposite directions. Above them were bright yellow ceramic chicks. These were stationary but very small.
Like to try your shooting skill before you exit the park? Fred asked. There are no losers today. Today, everybody wins a prize.
Mike looked around at Annie. Can I, Mom? Sure, honey. But not long, okay? He tried to get out of the chair, but couldn't. He was too tired. Lane and I propped him up, one on each side. Mike picked up a rifle and took a couple of shots, but he could no longer steady his arms, even though the gun was light. The BBs struck the canvas backdrop and clicked into the gutter at the bottom. Guess I suck, he said, putting the rifle down.
Well, you didn't exactly burn it up, Fred allowed. But as I said, today everyone wins a prize.
With that, he handed over the biggest Howie on the shelf, a top stuffy that even sharpshooters couldn't earn without spending $8 or $9 on reloads. Mike thanked him and sat back down, looking overwhelmed. That damn stuffed dog was almost as big as he was.
You try, Mom.
No, that's okay, she said. But I thought she wanted to. It was something in her eyes as she measured the distance between the chump board and the targets.
Please?
He looked first at me, then at Lane.
She's really good. She won the prone shooting tournament at Camp Perry before I was born and came in second twice. Camp Perry's in Ohio.
Lane was already holding out one of the modified .22s.
Step right up. Let's see your best Annie Oakley, Annie.
She took the rifle and examined it in a way few conies ever did. How many shots?
10 a clip, Fred said.
If I'm going to do this, can I shoot 2 clips?
As many as you want, ma'am. Today's your day.
Mom used to also shoot skeet with my grandpa, Mike told him. Annie raised the .22 and squeezed off 10 shots with a pause of perhaps 2 seconds between each. She knocked over 2 moving ducks and 3 of the moving bunnies. The teensy ceramic chicks she ignored completely.
A crack shot, Fred crowed. Any prize on the middle shelf, your pick.
She smiled. 50% isn't anywhere near crack. My dad would have covered his face for shame. I'll just take the reload if that's okay. Fred took a paper cone from under the counter, a wee shoot in the talk, and put the small end into a hole on top of the gag rifle. There was a rattle as another 10 BBs rolled in. Are the sights on these trigged? She asked Fred.
No, ma'am. All the games at Joyland are straight. But if I told you Pop Allen, the man who usually runs this shy, spent long hours sighting the men, I'd be a liar.
Having worked on Pop's team, I knew that was disingenuous, to say the least. Sighting the rifles was the last thing that Pop would do. The better the Rube shot, the more prizes Pop had to give away, and he had to buy his own prizes. All the shy bosses did. They were cheap goods, but not free goods. Shoots left and high, she said more to herself than to us. Then she raised the rifle, socked it into the hollow of her right shoulder, and triggered off 10 rounds. This time there was no discernible pause between the shots, and she didn't bother with ducks and bunnies. She aimed for the ceramic chicks and exploded 8 of them. As she put the gun back on the counter, Lane used his bandana to wipe a smudge of sweat and grime from the back of his neck. He spoke very softly as he did this chore.
Jesus, Horatio Christ. Nobody gets 8 beeps.
I only nicked the last one, and at this range I should have had them all. She wasn't boasting, just stating a fact. Mike said almost apologetically, Told you she was good. He curled a fist over his mouth and coughed into it.
She was thinking about the Olympics, only then she dropped out of college.
You really are Annie Oakley,
Lane said, stuffing his bandana back into her rear pocket.
Any prize, pretty lady. You pick.
I already have my prize, she said. This has been a wonderful, wonderful day. I can never thank you guys enough. She turned in my direction. And this guy, who actually had to talk me into it because I'm a fool, she kissed the top of Mike's head. But now I better get my boy home. Where's Milo? We looked around and saw him halfway down Joyland Avenue, sitting in front of Horror House with his tail curled around his paws.
Milo, come, Annie called.
His ears pricked up, but he didn't come. He didn't even turn in her direction, just stared at the facade of Joyland's only dark ride. I could almost believe he was reading the drippy cobweb-festooned invitation. Come in if you dare. While Annie was looking at Milo, I stole a glance at Mike. Although he was all but done in from the excitements of the day, his expression was hard to mistake. It was satisfaction. I know it's crazy to think that he and his Jack Russell had worked this out in advance, but I did think it. I still do.
Roll me down there, Mom, Mike said. He'll come with me.
No need for that, Lane said. If you've got a leash, I'm happy to go get him.
It's in the pocket on the back of Mike's wheelchair, Annie said. Probably not, Mike said. You can check, but I'm pretty sure I forgot it. Annie checked while I thought, in a pig's ass you did. Oh, Mike, Annie said reproachfully. Your dog, your responsibility. How many times have I told you?
Sorry, Mom,
to Fred and Lane, he said. Only we hardly ever use it because Milo always comes.
Except when we need him to. Annie cupped her hands around her mouth. Milo, come on! Time to go home!
Then in a much sweeter voice, Biscuit, Milo, come get a biscuit! Her coaxing tone would have brought me on the run, probably with my tongue hanging out, but Milo didn't budge.
Come on, Dev,
Mike said as if I were also in on the plan but had missed my cue somehow. I grabbed the wheelchair's handles and rolled Mike down Joyland Avenue toward the funhouse. Annie followed. Fred and Lane stayed where they were,
Lane leaning on the chump board among the laid-out pop guns on their chains. He had removed his derby and was spinning it on one finger. When we got to the dog, Annie regarded him crossly. "What's wrong with you, Milo?" Milo thumped his tail at the sound of Annie's voice, but didn't look at her, nor did he move. He was on guard and intended to stay that way unless he was hauled away. "Michael, please make your dog heal so we can go home. You need to get some re-" Two things happened before she could finish. I'm not exactly sure of the sequence. I've gone over it often in the years since then, most often on nights when I can't sleep and I'm still not sure. I think the rumble came first, the sound of a ride car starting to roll along its track, but it might have been the padlock dropping. It's even possible that both things happened at the same time. The big American Master fell off the double doors below the horror house facade and lay on the boards, gleaming in the October sunshine. Fred Dean said later that the shackle must not have been pushed firmly into the locking mechanism, and the vibration of the moving car caused it to open all the way. This made perfect sense because the shackle was indeed open when I checked it. Still bullshit, though. I put that padlock on myself and remember the click as the shackle clicked into place. I even remember tugging on it to make sure it caught the way you do with a padlock. And all that begs a question Fred didn't even try to answer. With the horror house breakers switched off, how could that car have gotten rolling in the first place? As for what happened next? Here's how a trip through Horror House ended. On the far side of the torture chamber, just when you thought the ride was over and your guard was down, a screaming skeleton, nicknamed Hagar the Horrible by the Greenies, came flying at you, seemingly on a collision course with your car. When it pulled away, you saw a stone wall dead ahead. Painted there in fluorescent green was a rotting zombie in a gravestone with "End of the Line" printed on it. Of course, the stone wall split open just in time, but that final double punch was extremely effective. When the car emerged into the daylight, making a semicircle before going back in through another set of double doors and stopping, even grown men were often screaming their heads off. Those final shrieks, always accompanied by gales of "Oh shit, you got me" laughter, were Horror House's best advertisement. There were no screams that day. Of course not, because when the double doors banged open, the car that emerged was empty. It rolled through the semicircle, bumped lightly against the next set of double doors, and stopped. "Okay," Mike said. It was a whisper so low that I barely heard it, and I'm sure Annie didn't. All her attention had been drawn to the car. The kid was smiling. "What made it do that?" Annie asked. "I don't know," I said. "Short circuit, maybe, or some kind of power surge?" Both of those explanations sounded good, as long as you didn't know about the breakers being off. I stood on my tiptoes and peered into the stalled car. The first thing I noticed was that the safety bar was up. If Eddie Parks or one of his greeny minions forgot to lower it, the bar was supposed to snap down automatically once the ride was in motion. It was a state-mandated safety feature. The bar being up on this one made a goofy kind of sense, though, since the only rides in the park that had power that morning were the ones that Lane and Fred had turned on for Mike. I spotted something beneath the semicircular seat, something as real as the roses Fred had given Annie, only not red. It was a blue Alice band. We headed back to the van. Milo, once more on his best behavior, padded along beside Mike's wheelchair. "I'll be back as soon as I get them home," I told Fred. "Put in some extra hours." He shook his head.
"You're 86 for today. Get to bed early and be here tomorrow at 6. Pack a couple of extra sandwiches because we'll all be working late. Turns out that storm's moving a little faster than the weather forecast is expected."
Annie looked alarmed. "Should I pack some stuff and take Mike to town, do you think? I'd hate to when he's so tired, but..."
"Check the radio this evening," Fred advised. "If no issues, a coastal evacuation order, you'll hear it in plenty of time. But I don't think that'll happen. This is just going to be your basic cap of wind. I'm a little worried about the high rides, that's all. The thunderball, the shaker, and the spin." "They'll be okay," Lane said. "They stood up to Agnes last year, and that was a bona fide hurricane."
"Does this storm have a name?" Mike asked.
"They're calling it Gilda," Lane said. But it's no hurricane, just a little old subtropical depression.
Fred said,
Winds are supposed to start picking up around midnight, and the heavy rain will start an hour or two later. Lane's probably right about the big rides, but it's still going to be a busy day. Have you got a slicker, Dev?
Sure.
You'll want to wear it.
The weather forecast we heard on WKLM as we left the park eased Annie's mind. The winds generated by Gilda weren't expected to top 30 miles an hour, with occasionally higher gusts. There might be some beach erosion and minor flooding inland, but that was about it. The DJ called it great kite-flying weather, which made us all laugh. We had a history now, and that was nice. Mike was almost asleep by the time we arrived back at the big Victorian on Beach Row. I lifted him into his wheelchair. It wasn't much of a chore. I'd put on muscle in the last 4 months, and with those horrible braces off, he couldn't have weighed 70 pounds. Milo once more paced the chair as I rolled it up the ramp and into the house. Mike needed the toilet, but when his mother tried to take over the wheelchair handles, Mike asked if I'd do it instead. I rolled him into the bathroom, helped him to stand, and eased down his elastic-waisted pants while he held onto the grab bars. I hate it when she has to help me. I feel like a baby. Maybe, but he pissed with a healthy kid's vigor. Then as he leaned forward to push the flush handle, he staggered and almost took a header into the toilet bowl. I had to catch him. Thanks, Dev. I already washed my hair once today. That made me laugh, and Mike grinned. I wish we were going to have a hurricane. That'd be boss. He might not think so if it happened. I was remembering Hurricane Doria 2 years before. It hit New Hampshire and Maine, packing 90-mile-an-hour winds, knocking down trees all over Portsmouth, Kittery, Sanford, and the Berwicks. One big old pine just missed our house. Our basement was flooded and the power had been out for 4 days. I wouldn't want stuff to fall down at the park, I guess. That's just about the best place in the world. That I've ever been, anyway. Good. Hold on, kid, let me pull your pants back up. Can't have you mooning your mother. That made him laugh again. Only the laughter turned to coughing. Annie took over when we came out, rolling him down the hall to the bedroom. Don't you sneak out on me, Devin, she called back over her shoulder. Since I had the afternoon off, I had no intention of sneaking out on her if she wanted me to stay a while. I strolled around the parlor, looking at things that were probably expensive but not terribly interesting. Not to a young man of 21, anyway. A huge picture window, almost wall to wall, saved what would otherwise have been a gloomy room, flooding it with light. The window looked out on the back patio, the boardwalk, and the ocean. I could see the first clouds feathering in from the southeast, but the sky overhead was still bright blue. I remember thinking that I'd made it to the big house after all, although I'd probably never have a chance to count all the bathrooms. I remember thinking about the Alice Band and wondering if Lane would see it when he put the wayward car back undercover. What else was I thinking? That I'd seen a ghost after all, just not of a person. Annie came back. He wants to see you, but don't stay long. Okay. Third door on the right. I went down the hall, knocked lightly, and let myself in. Once you got past the grab bars, the oxygen tanks in the corner, and the leg braces standing at steely attention beside the bed, could have been any boy's room. There was no baseball glove and no skateboard propped against the wall, but there were posters of Mark Spitz and Miami Dolphins running back Larry Zonka. In the place of honor above the bed, the Beatles were crossing Abbey Road. There was a faint smell of liniment. Mike looked very small in the bed, all but lost under a green coverlet. Milo was curled up, nose to tail beside him, and Mike was stroking his fur absently. It was hard to believe that this was the same kid who had his hands raised triumphantly over his head at the apogee of the Carolina spin. He didn't look sad, though. He looked almost radiant.
Did you see her, Dev? Did you see her when she left?
I shook my head, smiling. I had been jealous of Tom, but not of Mike. Never of Mike.
I wish my grandpa had been there. He would have seen her and heard what she said when she left.
What did she say?
Thanks.
She meant both of us. And she told you to be careful.
Are you sure you didn't hear, even a little?
I shook my head again. No, not even a little.
But you know.
His face was too pale and tired, the face of a boy who was very sick, but his eyes were alive and healthy.
You know, don't you? Yes. Thinking of the Alice Band. Mike, do you know what happened to her? Someone killed her. Very low. I don't suppose she told you. But there was no need to finish. He was shaking his head. You need to sleep, I said. Yeah, I'll feel better after a nap. I always do. His eyes closed and slowly opened again. The spin was the best. The hoister. It's like flying. Yes, I said. It is like that. Like being a kite. This time, when his eyes closed, they didn't reopen. I walked to the door as quietly as I could. As I put my hand on the knob, he said, Be careful, Dev. It's not white. I looked back. He was sleeping. I'm sure he was. Only Milo was watching me. I left, closing the door softly. Annie was in the kitchen. I'm making coffee, but maybe you'd rather have a beer. I've got Blue Ribbon. Coffee would be fine. What do you think of the place? I decided to tell the truth. The furnishings are a little elderly for my taste, but I never went to interior decorating school. Nor did I, she said. Never even finished college. Join the club. But you will. You'll get over the girl who dumped you, and you'll go back to school, and you'll finish, and you'll march off into a brilliant future. How do you know about the girl? One, you might as well be wearing a sandwich board. Two, Mike knows. He told me. He's been my brilliant future. Once upon a time, I was going to major in anthropology. I was going to win a gold medal at the Olympics. I was going to see strange and fabulous places and be the Margaret Mead of my generation. I was going to write books and do my best to earn back my father's love. Do you know who he is? My landlady says he's a preacher. Indeed he is. Buddy Ross, the man in the white suit. He also has a great head of white hair. He looks like an older version of the man from GLAAD in the TV ads. Mega church, big radio presence, now TV. Offstage, he's an asshole with a few good points. She poured two cups of coffee. But that's pretty much true of all of us, isn't it? I think so. You sound like someone with regrets. It wasn't the politest thing to say, but we were beyond that. I hope so, at least. She brought the coffee and sat down opposite me. Like the song says, I've had a few. But Mike's a great kid, and give my father this. He's taken care of us financially so I could be with Mike full time. The way I look at it, checkbook love is better than no love at all. I made a decision today. I think it happened when you were wearing that silly costume and doing that silly dance while I was watching Mike laugh. Tell me. I've decided to give my father what he wants, which is to be invited back into my son's life before it's too late. He said terrible things about how God caused Mike's MD to punish me for my supposed sins, but I've got to put that behind me. If I wait for an apology, I'll be waiting for a long time, because in his heart, Dad still believes that's true. I'm sorry. She shrugged as if it were no matter. I was wrong about not letting Mike go to Joyland, and I've been wrong about holding onto my grudges and insisting on some sort of fucked up quid pro quo. My son isn't goods in a trading post. Do you think 31's too old to grow up, Dev? Ask me when I get there. She laughed. Touché. Excuse me a minute. She was gone for almost 5. I sat at the kitchen table sipping my coffee. When she came back, she was holding her sweater in her right hand. Her stomach was tanned. Her bra was a pale blue, almost matching her faded jeans. Mike's fast asleep, she said. Would you like to go upstairs with me, Devin? Her bedroom was large but plain, as if even after all the months she had spent there, she'd never fully unpacked. She turned to me and linked her arms around my neck. Her eyes were very wide and very calm. A trace of a smile touched the corners of her mouth, making soft dimples. I bet you could do better if you had half a chance. Remember me saying that? Yes. Is that a bet I'd win? Her mouth was sweet and damp. I could taste her breath. She drew back and said, It can only be this once. You have to understand that. I didn't want to, but I did. Just as long as it's not, you know. She was really smiling now, almost laughing, I could see teeth as well as dimples. As long as it's not a thank you fuck, a mercy fuck, it's not, believe me. The last time I had a kid like you, I was a kid myself. She took my right hand and put it on the silky cup covering her left breast. I could feel the soft, steady beat of her heart. I must not have let go of all my daddy issues yet, because I feel delightfully wicked. We kissed again. Her hands dropped to my belt and unbuckled it. There was a soft rasp as my zipper went down, and then the side of her palm was sliding along the hard ridge beneath my shorts. I gasped. Dev? What? Have you ever done this before? Don't you dare lie to me. No. Was she an idiot, this girl of yours? I guess we both were. She smiled, slipped a cool hand inside my underwear, and gripped me. That sure hold, coupled with her gently moving thumb, made all of Wendy's efforts at boyfriend satisfaction seem very minor league. So you're a virgin? Guilty as charged. Good. It wasn't just the once, and that was lucky for me, because the first time lasted, I'm going to say, 8 seconds, maybe 9. I got inside, that much I did manage, but then everything spurted everywhere. I may have been more embarrassed once, the time I blew an ass trumpet while taking communion at Methodist youth camp, but I don't think so. Oh, God, I said and put a hand over my eyes. She laughed, but there was nothing mean about it. In a weird way, I'm flattered. Try to relax. I'm going downstairs for another check on Mike. I'd just as soon he didn't catch me in bed with Howie the Happy Hound. Very funny. I think if I'd blushed any harder, my skin would have caught fire. I think you'll be ready again when I come back. It's the nice thing about being 21, Dev. If you were 17, you'd probably be ready now. She came back with a couple of sodas in an ice bucket, but when she slipped out of her robe and stood there naked, Coke was the last thing I wanted. The second time was quite a bit better. I think I might have managed 4 minutes. Then she began to cry out softly and I was gone. But what a way to go. We drowsed, Annie with her head pillowed in the hollow of my shoulder. Okay? She asked. So okay, I can't believe it. I didn't see her smile, but I felt it. After all these years, this bedroom finally gets used for something besides sleeping. Doesn't your father ever stay here? Not for a long time, and I only started coming back because Mike loves it here. Sometimes I can face the fact that he's almost certainly going to die, but mostly I can't. I just turn away from it. I make deals with myself. If I don't take him to Joyland, he won't die. If I don't make up with my father so Dad can come and see him, he won't die. If we just stay here, he won't die. A couple of weeks ago, the first time I had to make him put on his coat to go down to the beach, I cried. He asked me what was wrong, and I told him it was my time of the month. He knows what that is. I remembered something Mike had said to her in the hospital parking lot. It doesn't have to be the last good time. But sooner or later, the last good time would come around. It does for all of us. She sat up, wrapping the sheet around her. Remember me saying that Mike turned out to be my future, my brilliant career? Yes. I can't think of another one. Anything beyond Michael is just blank. Who said that in America there are no second acts? I took her hand. Don't worry about Act Two until Act One is over. She slipped her hand free and caressed my face with it. You're young, but not entirely stupid. It was nice of her to say, but I certainly felt stupid. About Wendy, for one thing. But that wasn't the only thing. I found my mind drifting to those damn pictures in Aaron's folder. Something about them. She lay back down. The sheet slipped away from her nipples, and I felt myself begin to stir again. Some things about being 21 were pretty great. The shooting gallery was fun. I forgot how good it is. Sometimes just to have that eye and hand thing going on. My father put a rifle in my hands for the first time when I was 6. Just a little single-shot 22. I loved it. Yeah? She was smiling. Yeah, it was our thing. The thing that worked. The only thing, as it turned out. She propped herself up on an elbow. He's been selling that hellfire and brimstone shit since he was a teenager, and it's not just about the money. He got a triple helping of Backroads Gospels from his own parents, and I have no doubt he believes every word of it. You know what, though? He's still a Southern man first and a preacher second. He's got a custom pickup truck that costs $50,000, but a pickup truck is still a pickup truck. He still eats biscuits and gravy at Shoney's. His idea of sophisticated humor is Minnie Pearl and Junior Samples. He loves songs about cheating and honky-tonking, and he loves his guns. I don't care for his brand of Jesus, and I have no interest in owning a pickup truck, but the guns, that he passed on to his only daughter. I go bang bang and feel better. Shitty legacy, huh? I said nothing. Only got out of bed and opened the Cokes. I gave one to her. He's probably got 50 guns at his full-time place in Savannah, most of them valuable antiques, and there's another half dozen in the safe here. I've got two rifles of my own at my place in Chicago, although I hadn't shot at a target for 2 years before today. If Mike dies... She held the Coke bottle to the middle of her forehead as if trying to soothe a headache. When Mike dies, the first thing I'm going to do is get rid of them all. They'd be too much temptation. Mike wouldn't want... No, of course not. I know that. But it's not all about him. If I could believe like my holy hat father that I was going to find Mike waiting outside the Golden Gates to show me in after I die, that would be one thing. But I don't. I tried my ass off to believe that when I was a little girl, and I couldn't. God in heaven lasted about 4 years longer than the Tooth Fairy. But in the end, I couldn't. I think there's just darkness. No thought, no memory, no love. Just darkness. Oblivion. That's why I find what's happening to him so hard to accept. Mike knows it's more than oblivion, I said. What? Why? Why do you think that? Because she was there. He saw her and he saw her go because she said thank you. And I know because I saw the Alice band, and Tom saw her. Ask him, I said, but not today. She put her Coke aside and studied me. She was wearing the little smile that put dimples at the corners of her mouth. You've had seconds. I don't suppose you'd be interested in thirds. I put my Coke down beside the bed. As a matter of fact, she held out her arms. The first time was embarrassing. The second time was good. The third, man, the third time was a charm. I waited in the parlor while Annie dressed. When she came downstairs, she was back in her jeans and sweater. I thought of the blue bra just beneath the sweater, and damned if I didn't feel that stirring again. Are we good? She said. Yes, but I wish we could be even better. I wish that too. But this is as good as it's ever going to get. If you like me as much as I like you, you'll accept that. Can you? Yes. Good. How much longer will you and Mike be here? If the place doesn't blow away tonight, you mean? It won't. A week. Mike's got a round of specialists back in Chicago starting on the 17th, and I want to get settled before then. She drew in a deep breath and talked to his grandpa about a visit. There'll have to be some ground rules, no Jesus for one. Will I see you again before you leave? Yes. She put her arms around me and kissed me. Then she stepped away. But not like this. It would confuse things too much. I know you get that. I nodded. I got it. You better go now, Dev. And thank you. It was lovely. We saved the best ride for last, didn't we? That was true. Not a dark ride, but a bright one. I wish I could do more. For you. For Mike. So do I, she said. But that's not the world we live in. Come by tomorrow for supper if the storm's not too bad. Mike would love to see you. She looked beautiful, standing there barefooted in her faded jeans. I wanted to take her in my arms and lift her and carry her into some brilliant, untroubled future. Instead, I left her where she was. That's not the world we live in, she'd said. And how right she was. How right she was. About 100 yards down Beach Row, on the inland side of the Tulane, there was a little cluster of shops too tony to be called a strip mall. A gourmet grocery, a salon called Hair's Looking at You, a drugstore, a branch of the Southern Trust, and a restaurant called Mi Casa, where the beach row elite no doubt meant to eat. I didn't give those shops so much as a glance when I drove back to Heaven's Bay and Mrs. Shoplaw's. If ever I needed proof that I didn't have the gift that Mike Ross and Rosie Gold shared, that was it.
Go to bed early, Fred Deenan told me, and I did.
I lay on my back with my hands behind my head, listening to the waves as I had all summer long, remembering the touch of her hands, the firmness of her breasts, the taste of her mouth. Mostly it was her eyes I thought about, and the fan of her hair on the pillow. I didn't love her the way I loved Wendy. That sort of love so strong and stupid only comes once. But I loved her. I did then, and I still do now. For her kindness, mostly, and her patience. Some young man somewhere may have had a better initiation into the mysteries of sex, but no young man ever had a sweeter one. Eventually, I slept. It was a banging shutter somewhere below that woke me. I picked my watch up from the night table and saw it was 1:15. I didn't think there was going to be any more sleep for me until that banging stopped, so I got dressed, started out the door, and then returned to the closet for my slicker. When I got downstairs, I paused. From the big bedroom down the hall from the parlor, I could hear Mrs. S. sawing wood in long, noisy strokes. No banging shutter was going to break her rest. It turned out I didn't need the slicker, at least not yet, because the rain hadn't started. The wind was strong, though. It had to be blowing 25 already. The low, steady thud of the surf had become a muted roar. I wondered if the weather boffins had underestimated Gilda, thought of Annie and Mike in the house down the beach, and felt a tickle of unease. I found the loose shutter and refastened it with the hook and eye. I let myself back in, went upstairs, undressed, and lay down again. This time, sleep wouldn't come. The shutter was quiet, but there was nothing I could do about the wind moaning around the eaves and rising to a low scream each time it gusted. Nor could I turn off my brain now that it was running again. It's not white, I thought. That meant nothing to me, but it wanted to mean something. It wanted to connect with something I had seen at the park during our visit. There is a shadow over you, young man. That had been Rosie Gold on the day that I had met her. I wondered how long she had worked at Joyland and where she had worked before. Was she Carney from Carney? And what did it matter?
One of these children has this sight. I don't know which.
I knew. Mike had seen Linda Gray and set her free. He had, as they say, shown her the door. The one she hadn't been able to find herself. Why else would she have thanked him? I closed my eyes and saw Fred at the shooting gallery, resplendent in his suit and magic top hat. I saw Lane holding out one of the .22s chained to the chump board. Annie. How many shots?
Fred. 10 a clip, as many as you want. Today's your day.
My eyes flew open as several things came crashing together in my mind. I sat up, listening to the wind and the agitated surf. Then I turned on the overhead light and got Aaron's folder out of my desk drawer. I laid the photographs on the floor again, my heart pounding. The pics were good, but the light wasn't. I dressed for the second time, shoved everything back into the folder, and made another trip downstairs. A lamp hung above the Scrabble table in the middle of the parlor, and I knew from the many evenings I'd gotten my ass kicked that the light it cast was plenty bright. There were sliding doors between the parlor and the hall leading to Mrs. S.'s quarters. I pulled them shut so the light wouldn't disturb her. Then I turned on the lamp, moved the Scrabble box to the top of the TV, and laid my photos out. I was too agitated to sit down. I bent over the table instead, arranging and rearranging the photographs. I was about to do that for the third time when my hand froze. I saw it. I saw him. Not proof that would stand up in court, no, but enough for me. My knees came unhinged and I sat down after all. The phone I had used so many times to call my father, always noting down the time and duration on the guest call honor sheet when I was done, suddenly rang. Only in that windy early morning silence, it sounded more like a scream. I lunged at it and picked up the receiver before it could ring again.
Hello? It was all I could manage. My heart was pounding too hard for more. It's you, the voice on the other end said. He sounded both amused and pleasantly surprised. I was expecting your landlady. I had a story about a family emergency already. I tried to speak. Couldn't. Devin? Teasing, cheerful. Are you there? Just a second. I held the phone in my chest, wondering. It's crazy how your mind can work when it's put under sudden stress. If he could hear my heart at his end of the line. On mine, I listened for Mrs. Shoplaw. I heard her too, the muted sound of her continuing snores. It was a good thing I'd closed the parlor doors and a better thing that there was no extension in her bedroom. I put the phone back to my ear and said, "What do you want? Why are you calling?" "I think you know, Devin. And if you didn't, it's too late now, isn't it? Are you psychic too?" It was stupid. But right then my brain and my mouth seemed to be running on separate tracks. "That's Rosie," he said. "Our Madame Fortuna." He actually laughed. He sounded relaxed, but I doubt if he was. Killers don't make phone calls in the middle of the night if they're relaxed, especially if they can't be sure of who's going to answer the phone. But he had a story, I thought. This guy's a Boy Scout. He's crazy, but he's always prepared. The tattoo, for instance, that's what takes your eye when you look at those photos. Not the face. Not the baseball cap. "I knew what you were up to," he said. "I knew even before the girl brought you that folder. The one with the pictures in it. Then today, with the pretty mommy and the crippled kid. Have you told them, Devin? Did they help you work it out?" "They don't know anything." The wind gusted. I could hear it at his end, too, as if he were outside. "I wonder if I can believe you." "You can. You absolutely can." Looking down at the pictures. Tattoo man with his hand on Lena Gray's ass. Tattoo man helping her aim the rifle at the shooting gallery. Lane. "Let's see your best Annie Oakley, Annie." Fred. "A crack shot." Tattoo man in his fish-top cap and dark glasses and sandy blonde goatee. You could see the bird tattoo on his hand because the rawhide gloves had stayed in his back pocket until he and Linda Gray were in the horror house. Until he had her in the dark. "I wonder," he said again. "You were in that big old house for a long time this afternoon, Devin. Were you talking about the pictures the cook girl brought? Or were you just fucking her? Maybe it was both. Mommy's a tasty piece, all right." "They don't know anything," I repeated. I was speaking low and fixing my gaze on the closed parlor doors. I kept expecting them to open and see Mrs. S. standing there in her nightgown, her face ghostly with cream. "Neither do I. Not that I could prove." "Probably not, but it would only be a matter of time. You can't unring the bell. Do you know that old saying?" "Sure, sure." I didn't, but at that moment I would have agreed with him if he had declared that Bobby Rydell, a yearly performer at Joyland, was president. "Here's what you're going to do. You're going to come to Joyland, and we'll talk this out face to face, man to man."
"Why would I do that? That'd be pretty crazy if you're who I..."
"Oh, you know who I am."
He sounded impatient. "And I know that if you went to the police, they'd find out I came on board at Joyland only a month or so after Linda Gray was killed. Then they'd put me with the Wellman Show and the Southern Star Amusements. And there goes the ballgame. So why don't I call them right now?
Do you know where I am?"
Anger was creeping into his voice. "No. Venom.
Do you know where I am right now, you nosy little son of a bitch?"
"Joyland, probably an admin."
"Not at all. I'm at the shopping center on Beach Row. The one where the rich bitches go to buy their macrobiotics. Rich bitches like your girlfriend.